I need to see that, and then Bayesian and Latin to actually move my talk here so that I can actually do this parameter for the first time. So it's really nice to be here. What I'm going to tell you today about is how the high resolution observations of the CMB from ACT is actually changing the field of the CMB in a fundamental way, how it can prove fundamental physics with CMB and the gravitational lensing of the CMB. I will not actually go over all the results that ACT has produced, because it will be a long talk then, but I'll just focus on a couple of things as I go. So just to give you a background here, this is a timeline of the universe that we have seen many, many times, so I won't belabor it, but there are five major milestones here. So you have the period of inflation, where the universe grows exponentially, gets flat, and the seeds of structure formation are produced. And then you have the Big Bang nucleosynthesis, where light elements form. We think that the standard model gives a good picture of the Big Bang nucleosynthesis, but does it? So that's going to be one of the points of this talk, is whether there is room for physics beyond the standard model. Then there is recombination. Recombination actually pays for my salary, because if recombination didn't happen, the CMB photons won't be freed. So what happens here is the electrons and protons form hydrogen atoms, so there are no free electrons left for the CMB photons to scatter from, and that's how the CMB is born. So the photons get free, and they free stream to us, and we see the fluctuations in the microwave background, as you see here in the WMAP map. So and later, we start out with a very homogeneous universe with these seeds of structure formation that were set up during inflation. There is structure formation happens in between here and here, and you see nonlinear structures growing, this cosmic wave forming. And finally, in recent time, we know from supernova studies that the universe has entered this phase of accelerated expansion. So one of the most remarkable things of this picture, I mean, this is this history spanning a large order of magnitude in time and energy scales, but it seems like observations over all these era can be explained quite simply and neatly by one model, simple model, which has adiabatic nearly scale invariant parallel Gaussian fluctuations to start with. Then you assume flatness, then you put in a universe, you have 5% of the stuff that we are made of, and then you put in 22% cold dark matter, and the rest is dark energy, which could be a cosmological constant. But once you assume this model, it really nicely fits observations over a large range of time and scales. So you have the CMB, which is really the imprint of the primordial universe. You're seeing the universe there at redshift 1100. And then you look at the distribution of galaxies in the nearby universe. You take the power spectra, and you try to fit a line through this, which is basically a time-evolved version of the power spectrum that you see in the CMB, and it fits. And then you see the supernovae, and with this simple six-parameter model, you can fit the expansion of the universe, the acceleration of the expansion of the universe in this time. And this is what we call the lambda CDN model. Okay, but within this beautiful picture, there are big questions, right? So what is what is the mechanism that drove inflation? What's the energy scale of inflation is a very big question. And then in the dark sector, we want to know what dark energy is made of. Is it really a cosmological constant? Is it just a constant that you put in the Einstein's equation? Or is it really something, more dynamical? Is it something really more physical? And then there is the dark matter problem. We want to know what dark matter is made of. And in the particle sector, we know that neutrinos have mass, but we don't know how much mass there is in the neutrinos and what the mass hierarchy of neutrinos are. So there is room for physics beyond standard model also. If you find that there is an extra species of relativistic particles in the early universe, then it might signal some new physics. So all these things, can actually be probed from the CMB. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about today, is how the high resolution observations of the CMB are actually probing all these different eras. So this is color-coded here. And you can see from the higher order peaks in the CMB power spectrum, you can actually get clues about inflation. You can look at the tilt and the running of this primordial power spectrum, the tensor to scalar ratios. But then more interestingly to me, you can actually also probe BVN. So you can actually have an independent constraint at redshift of 1100 of the amount of helium that was there in the universe. And then also you can constrain the number of total relativistic species. Okay, so these are completely independent from other observations. And then structure formation, there I'm going to tell you about the gravitational lensing of the CMB. So this is something which is also, which you also see when you have a CMB map of high enough resolution. And there, that helps you constrain the total mass of neutrinos. And I'll kind of try to explain how, and the growth of structure. And dark energy and the geometry of the universe, this can all be studied under gravitational lensing of the CMB. So one thing I'm going to leave out of this talk is this whole aspect of the Sunayev-Zeldovich effect, which is really, really interesting. But today I'm just going to focus on what you can learn from higher order peaks and gravitational lensing of the CMB. So let's move forward. So ongoing experiments are already probing this high resolution regime. So you have the South Pole Telescope, you have Planck, and Dick will tell us about Planck later. And there is ACT is in red because that's what I work on. And then I'm going to actually be partial here and talk about ACT only. But South Pole Telescope is very competitive and it's producing very similar results. So all the science case I'm putting up here, it's really being complemented by ACT and SDT. So the way we are changing, the view of the CMB is by actually going to higher resolution and higher sensitivity. So if you look back in time, when we had COBE, we had a resolution of about 7 degrees. So what I'm showing here is a disk of 1 degree diameter that's cut out from one of these maps. And you can see from COBE to WMAP through, this is a simulation from Planck, I don't have the data, because. And then this is ACT. So you can see as the resolution is increasing, things like point sources and Sunayev-Zeldovich clusters pop up, but also each of these hot and cold spots, which are really, imprints on the last scattering surface, you also resolve a lot of tiny structure in it. And that kind of means in Fourier space that you're going to look, going to constrain the power spectrum of the CMB at high L and also look at distortion of the CMB. So now coming to the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, it's a telescope, many of you know, it's located in Chile. It has run for 3 seasons now. It is a 6-meter primary mirror, which basically means it has about an arc in resolution and psi. We have 3 channels kind of straddling the null of the Sunayev-Zeldovich effect, which is 218 meters. So in this channel, you would see an SZ cluster as a decrement, whereas in the 280 gigahertz channel, you would see a cluster as an increment. And that was kind of one of the reasons we chose these frequencies. And then there are 1,000 detector elements in each of these channels. And, doing data reduction and map making with 1,000 detectors is hard because you cannot name them. But as John will tell you, so from the observations of the ACT, we have been publishing regularly. So here's a list of our publications. It's kind of color coded. So we have published on point sources. We have a lot of publications on the Sunayev-Zeldovich effect, and then there is these ones are on the power spectra and cross correlations of ACT data with other data sets. Amir here has led the power spectrum, Amir and Marco Viero, they just put out this very interesting paper on the cross-correlations in ACT and BLAST. There's also another paper which is a cross-correlation between ACT and luminous red galaxies in the CSS, and we'll get to that towards the end of the talk. So there's a lot of interesting science that we have already been putting out. So we have observed about 1,800 square degrees on the sky, and this kind of shows our coverage. So we have a southern patch here, which is shown here. And then we also covered the Stripe 82 region. So this is a region which has been deeply covered by Sloan. So we have a lot of optical data there. So basically, we have concentrated on these two strips on the sky. And we have made maps from the data. So here I'm kind of condensing into one slide many, many hours of man and computer work. So as you can see, getting the raw time stream data into a map that looks such as nice as this one is a lot of work. So you have to calibrate all these different thousand detectors. You have to solve for pointing on the sky. You have to make cuts on your data. And then you have to put it in a, you know, a solver to solve for the best possible map. And one thing that helps us in this case in solving the map is the fact that we do cross-linking. So when the sky is rising in the east, we scan it. But then at the end of the night, when the same patch is setting, we scan it again. And that way, we get a cross-linked pattern. So we see every point on the sky going in two different directions, which kind of helps us to separate what's the signal and what's the noise. And so John has really been the lead, and this has been possible due to Cynet, you know, because we need 100,000 CPU hours to reduce 1 second of data. And without Cynet, it'll take many years. So here is an example of a patch of the sky that's cut out from this solution. And you can see the degree scale CMB, the tiny clusters, and the point sources all well expressed in this one map, which means that it has information on all these different scales. And it has been, you know, one of the things we kind of claim is that it's really almost an unbiased view of the sky on all scales. So because I won't talk much about the Tsunayev Zeldovich clusters, I just wanted to show you this pretty picture. So we have been finding a lot of the SC clusters now. Actually, the total now is about 50, including the equatorial maps. And here are some of the, you know, mug shots of those clusters. And some of them have really nice properties. Some of them show these nice gravitational lensing arcs. So, you know, if you want to follow this up, you know, we just put out a lot of a few very interesting papers on SC clusters to look at Marid et al. And Menantu et al. But the main thing today is going to be the power spectrum and lensing. So let's go back to that. So here is the key step that you have to do to actually get any signs out of the ACK data. So you have made this map, which is, you know, which looks really nice. It has information on all scales. But you have to actually make sure that each pixel has the correct value. So it has to be calibrated. So what we do is calibrate the map against the WMAP maps. So here I'm showing an animation that Amir made, where we go from a WMAP, a patch of the sky which is cut out from WMAP, and then we slowly start adding information from ACT, so we actually start resolving these hot and cold spots. I would draw your attention to this guy here. This is my favorite spot in this map. So as you see, you know, ACT basically resolves this one big blotch into this tiny little hot and cold spot. And that's the power of the resolution of ACT. But also, by cross-correlating the WMAP map with ACT maps, we have come up with a very nice 2-person calibration. And this is all Amir's work. You can look at this paper here. So that 2-person calibration is really the key in a lot of the parameter results that I'm going to show you today. So here is a WMAP. And there are a lot of experiments that have covered this range. But I'm really being mean here, and I'm only going to show you ACT results here. So so when you put in ACT, this is how it looks. And, you know, then you say, how does the theory look? That's the theory. Okay. So
that 2% calibration compares with what is the calibration of WMAP by itself? I mean, how accurately calibrated are these?
I mean, we take the WMAP as a standard.
It's less than half a percent.
Is it half a percent?
It's almost 0.2%.
Yeah. So can we really, it's basically the gold standard.
Is that the right whole number, or is that what it means?
It's in temperature, right? 0.2%.
Sorry. The lower.
So the absolute calibration is the relevant.
So it's in temperature.
Yeah.
So this is also a temperature, not a temperature spread. So anyway, let me go back to this plot. So, you know, when we generated this spectrum, really we had to go back and make sure this was not the simulation. So the peaks came out so nice. But I'm going to show you something now which is not published yet. So when you take this southern 300 square degrees and the 300 square degrees on the equator, like on the stripe 82, and you combine them, you see the power spectrum looks even nicer. So this is new. This is just a few weeks old. You see the error bars roughly go you know, almost like half, not exactly half, because our equatorial stripe is much deeper than the southern stripe. So you know, we haven't run parameters on it yet, so I'm not going to be able to show you what parameter constant we get. But we're expecting to get really interesting things. And, you know, John is actually going to look into that over the next few weeks. So we not only covered this range in 3000 because we have one arc in beam, we can go all the way out to 10,000. And as you can see, when you go there, the power spectrum deviates from what you expect from only CMD. And that's because you get a contribution from synapse delivery effect and point sources. And those are the things I'm not going to talk about here, but they are really very interesting things to also go after. So what does what do these high order peaks buy you? Okay. So here we're showing several curves that are all consistent with WMAP. So you can see this is the WMAP data here. All the curves go through the points, and they're all consistent within one sigma with WMAP. And you can pick crazy values like n effective, which is the number, total effective number of relativistic species during recombination. And that's, you can take something like 10. You know, it's really not well constrained by WMAP alone. Then you can take a helium fraction whose standard value from DVM should be something like 0.25. You can take it to 0.5. And those, as you can see, are largely ruled out by measuring these higher level peaks.
That's right. Sorry? When you're doing this, you fix all other parameters?
No, you are varying the standard and the seeding values.
Okay, so you said when YP is 0.5, you vary everything, or?
We'll show the, you know, the results. But then, here is the interesting thing. So if you look at, so what you're probing with this peak, so let me just go back here. So helium, right? So if you have more helium, if you increase the density of helium, means that you have less free electrons, which means
the photons are, you know, free to wash out the structure in the primordial plasma, so you get more damping. So the higher order peaks get more damped, and that's basically what you're sensitive to. And then from that you get a six sigma detection of helium from CMD alone. But look at this value here; this value is trying to, you know, go around 0.313, which is away from the standard value, which is shown in the dotted lines here. And this is not to cause any alarm here. It's all within, it's consistent within, you know, 2 sigma. But, you know, the real question is, are we seeing some hints already of something, you know, different? So here is the standard DBM picture, and I think the next talk is on DBN, and you'll see this again. And what ACT is trying to say, ACT plus WMAP, is that helium measured from the CMD peak is somewhere up here, whereas the standard value would be around, you know, 0.25. Same thing with the number of effective relativistic species. The standard number, yeah.
Come down.
I think in the paper it was written that recombination corrections are not yet at the error bar, which is necessary. I talked to Eric about it, and Eric was sort of looking at that, I think.
Yeah.
But with the improved,
we should be on
it. You should be basically seeing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interestingly, if you vary helium in addition to the standard 6 parameters, you actually bias helium if you neglect the recombination corrections, and you bias it high, so it pushes it up. It's just interesting because we are putting out a paper basically. Maybe today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
Just showing how these biases are shuffling around.
Yeah.
And neutrinos actually are also biased high.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
So it might all be, you know, nice and consistent. But, you know, in recent years, WMAP and also ACT, they're also kind of showing a little high value of number of effective relativistic species. And the standard value in BVM is, you know,
this number that we always put in CAM, 3.04. Basically, 3 species of neutrinos. So the question is, you know, in this picture of N effective versus YP, and they are correlated in DBN, because if you increase the number of effective relativistic species in the early universe, then you delay the radiation matter equality, then you also have a longer time for weak interaction frees out, so you actually end up producing more helium because you have a larger neutron to proton ratio. And so you can see the BVN curve is like this, where you have more and effective would mean more helium. And this is the contour that we get from Ax plus W max. And the question is, you know, after we put in all these corrections, where this contour is going to move. So right now the standard value is at the edge of the 1 sigma contour, and how it's going to shrink. So this is where Planck will also come in really with very strong constraints. But these higher order peaks are really the very independent way of going after the physics of the standard form and keep bang nuclear systems. The other thing is with polarization, where you can actually look deeper into the damping tail, because the foregrounds are expected to be lower, we would get additional constraints and additional handles on the same physics that I've talked to you about in the previous few slides. So that brings me to polarization and our plans with polarization. So we are going to put a polarization enabled camera into ACT, and we're going online in early 2013 with it, and we are calling it ACTPOL. So ACTPOL is totally funded, and it's going to happen. And so the science we're going after with ACTPOL, there are two kinds of science you can go after with polarization. One is if you can go after these very large scale modes to look for the gravitational wave signature, which would then constrain the energy scale of inflation. But with a 1 arcsecond resolution telescope, you're not really going to go after this. What you're going to go after is this high L part, where most of the signal is coming from, in the BV, is coming from the lensing of the E modes. So the E modes on the sky, they get lensed by intervening large scale structure, and you see this lensed B signal out here. And that's something you should definitely measure at the specification for that pole. So that kind of gives me a nice point to segue into lensing. But before going there, just let me show you what the projections of ACTPOL are. So here in green are Planck's error bars, and they have been dimmed, so they actually look smaller than you'd see in standard Planck tables. But with the same binning, we are showing the projected error bars from ACTPOL. So here is CLEE, here's the BV signal, and this assumes no primordial B. This is only the lensing B that we're measuring here, and we will be able to measure the lensing B with sufficiently high accuracy. So this gives me a nice point to actually go into lensing now. So lensing is really simple. It's one of the simplest secondary anisotropies you can think of. So it's not really a secondary anisotropy per se. It's a distortion of the CMB due to bending of light by intervening large scale structure potential. One thing to keep in mind is that the RMS deflection of a CMB photon between you and the last scattering surface is about 3 arcminutes. It's really not small. But what's more interesting is that because the large scale potentials on the sky are coherent on degree scales, these deflections are also coherent on this degree scale. So think of like a vector field of deflections, where these tiny arrows are each 3 arcminutes long, but these arrows are all coherent. They all point in roughly the same direction on about a degree scale. And if you remember, the hot and cold spots in the CMB are also on the degree scale. So you would expect distortions of the hot and cold spots from lensing. And so this is a simulation I did with Paul Budde back when I was doing a PhD at Princeton. And here I'm showing an animation with lensed and unlensed. It's, which one is lensed, which one is unlensed. It's a wrong question to ask at this point. But I would use the same slide to actually introduce some lensing jargon here. So how do we, express the lens CMB field? So if you're looking at some point theta phi in the sky, your lens field is essentially a deflected version of the primordial field theta here, which is deflected by a deflection grad phi, where phi is what we call the lensing potential. And what this lensing potential is, it's nothing but a redshift weighted, a two-dimensional version of the three-dimensional potentials, matter potentials along the line of sight. And its gradient is this deflection field g, and sometimes we would work with the scalar version, the divergence of g, which is called the convergence of the lensing field. So I will use this term a little bit in the next few slides. But before going into how you actually, you know, extract the lensing signal, there is one more interesting effect that lensing has, and that's really easy to understand. So suppose CMB was only 1 degree hot and cold spots. If you took its power spectrum, it would really be a peak at some frequency. Now, after lensing, some of these hot and cold spots, they get, you know, dilated. Some of them get, you know, squeezed. And therefore, you end up not having a sharp peak, but a distribution of size. So in terms of the real CMB, it means that all these peaks in the power spectrum, they get smoothed by lensing. So here I'm showing, you know, in blue, the blue line here is the unlensed or the primordial CMB spectrum, whereas the orange line here is the version that you get after lensing. So just by measuring these peaks out here, the higher order peaks, you can actually start proving lensing. And the way we did that in this, in our recent power spectrum paper, is we said, what if we scale the lensing potential by some value, which is really expected to be, you know, distributed around 1 if everything is correct. And if you don't have lensing in our data, then it should be 0. So here you see what we get. This is the likelihood for this parameter AL. And it's nicely consistent with 1. And then to test our pipeline, we ran it on an unlensed simulation, which has been ran through everything from map making to power spectrum estimation. And for that, we found it to be consistent with 0. So this actually translates to about a 3 sigma detection of lensing from the peaks, the smoothing of the peaks alone.
Can that peak at 0?
I'm not sure, actually. That's a very good question.
Is that one simulation?
It's not consistent. But the thing is, we did see a little bit of excess in the unlensed simulation than we expected in some,
but that's beyond the point here. But yeah. No, it's just 1. Yeah, just 1. So so that's the smoothing of peaks effect. But what we are really going after is really this potential. If we can actually extract this potential from the lens CMB field, then it will be really interesting, because this potential depends both on geometry, so these are angular diameter distances, and the matter potential. So this gives you a probe. This makes your CMB a probe of both geometry and matter potential across the history of the universe, which is really interesting. And what that lets you do is break some of the degeneracies that exist in the primordial CMB. So if you just had, you know, the last scattering surface and no physics beyond that, then it doesn't really matter, you know, how much mass neutrinos have. You know, if they're sub-electron voltage neutrinos, they would behave like relativistic particles at during the termination. And then if you have curvature or dark energy, they don't really affect the physics of the last scattering surface. But because of lensing, all these things affect the large-scale structure. And because of lensing, you can actually say something about these parameters and break these differences. So this is the real golden goal for CMB lensing. So we actually have to do a lot of simulations, and we have done, you know, ray tracing simulations to large boxes to generate lensed CMB fields. And this is the plot I put up on the title slide. It was not really CMB. There's the difference between lensed and unlensed CMB. And the reason I'm putting it up here is that you can see these, you know, sinuous structures in this difference map, which kind of tells you this effect is really very non-Gaussian. And this is something you'll see in the 4-point functional temperature map. And that's really the way to go after this deflective field. So the name of the game here is lensing reconstruction. It's something similar to what you do with galaxies. So when you have galaxies, the galaxies get coherently distorted by lensing, and then you assume that the average shape of a galaxy is a circle, you know, and then you try to extract from that what the dark matter distribution in front of it is. Whereas in the CMB, it's slightly different, because you have a continuous field as your source, which you know to be a Gaussian random field to a very high accuracy. So once you have deflection, I mean, this is really, really highly exaggerated version here, but you know, that field gets distorted and it induces some non-Gaussianity in the field. And then you try to use that information to actually reconstruct the deflection field that actually you observe in the observed CMB field, because you're never going to observe this original field. But the way it distorts the statistics of the field lets you recover, albeit with some noise, the deflection field that distorted the field.
It introduces non-stationarity but maintains Gaussianity. That's what you mean to say.
That's what I mean to say, yes. But it also breaks locally isotropy.
Yes.
What was that? You said
non-stationarity? Yeah, it stays
Gauss. But it does induce four-point function in the CMP, which is non-trivial. If you
pick the wrong frame, yes. Yeah. But if you in the right frame, there's no four-point function.
Okay. So anyway, so you can actually do this in simulations. So here is the simulation where I'm showing now the convergence field. You have a question?
Are there other comparable contaminants to the non-stationarity four-point function?
I mean, there are things that can induce similar type of signals, but you know, either with spectral information or with some templates, you can try to subtract them out. But this is really a very particular configuration of the temperature field that lets you reconstruct the lens. But something like, you know, coordinate point sources they actually show up as additional bias.
But the pointing error of a detector would exactly look the same.
It would be especially for polarization, it's a problem. But for a crosslink, snap, temperature only, it's actually not a big problem.
I want to go back to what Wei Li said, because I don't get it. How do you get rid of the non-Gaussianity?
Well,
what kind of frame did you say you were in?
I wanted to know this, but I wanted to ask you after the talk.
Well, no, you got to challenge him now because it doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, the covariance matrix of temperature is still given by a covariance matrix of pixels on the sky, even after your lenses. The only difference is that this covariance matrix in normal CMB depends only on the separation between two points. If you add lensing, then the statistics of the temperature field depends not just on separation, but on the actual position on the sky.
But if I, for example, let's just deal with power spectrum space.
Right.
The power spectrum is got all of this e to the ik dot, I guess your d's, right, that are attached to it, which has the whole hierarchy higher order moments.
Well,
so how did you make that disappear?
Oh, because if you rotate the eigenspace as a covariance matrix, normally in a stationary CMB, the eigenspace of the covariance matrix are the YLMs of the sky. If you have lensing, then if you diagonalize the covariance matrix of the temperature function, it's no longer YLMs, it's the eigenmodes on a different manifold. But if you use that as your basis for your eigenspace of your covariance matrix, all the Wicks theorem, everything holds, all the high-order functions are still Gaussian, everything's fine if you go into the correct eigenspace of the correct covariance function.
And you can write this down in advance without knowing the position of the potential?
Yeah, I don't still get it.
Well, I mean, it's like any variance estimation, right? Your unknown is something you do with mathematics. Yeah, I mean, it's like anything. If you have a windowed measurement of the CMB, you've got the same problem.
I mean, that's exactly what you're looking for.
Well, no, but I mean,
it's the parameterization of the covariance matrix. Normally, write as band powers and L, and not write as.
I have a feeling we should move on, and this cannot be resolved right.
Yes, let's do this afterwards. I'm really interested, but. Anyway,
I see this four-point function in the simulations because I obviously used the wrong eigenspace. But I have input, and what I'm showing here is that this reconstruction is doable. And here I'm showing an input convergence field. And so this is a simulation with low noise. And here is the reconstructed one. And you can see the reconstructed one has noise in it, and it's inevitable. If you have a reconstruction, it will have a bias that comes with it, you know, from this noise curve. But the nice thing is that once you have reconstructed this, you can also think of not only taking sparse spectrum, but also cross-correlating this diffraction field with other things that correlate with dark matter. For example, galaxies, you know, high redshift quasars, submillimeter galaxies which live at high redshift. So lensing of the CMB, and at one point which I kind of, you know, missed before, is that it's very sensitive to things that are between redshift 2 and 5. So it's really probing a high redshift range of the matter potential. So any high redshift object behind which there is nothing else to lens, you know, CMB is the only kind of source to do cross-correlations between lensing and directly the dark matter. So of course there's 21 centimeter that can do that, but that's far in the future. So the status of this now is that, you know, we have the whole pipeline set up. If you put in only white noise, which, you know, everyone does in the theory papers, we do detect lensing at the level of the noise that we have in ACT. We would detect it. So here I'm showing a simulation, and this is work with a graduate student, Blake Sherwin of Princeton, who's working on this lensing detection routine. And we also put out a method for actually doing this without bias. So you can actually do the reconstruction in kind of Fourier space in two different annuli, and then you cross-correlate the result, and the result will not have any bias. So look up this paper, but the price you pay for doing that is, of course, you get a hit on signal to noise. So at the level of signal that we have now in ACT, that seems not to be an option, because, you know, then the signal will go below the detection limit. But yes. Yeah, but the thing is, you cannot make the shells arbitrarily small, given the geometry of the map. So if your map is 3 degrees across, then you have a fundamental resolution of 180 over 3. That's a delta L of 60. You cannot resolve anything inside that. So
shells, you can make some patches, and then you get any number you want, right?
Yeah, but that's, we are looking into that, but it's, but as Willy says, it's not that you, not just two annuli that you should consider. There are, you know, you can break the annuli into other annuli, but that's, you know, kind of, that was just an advertisement for this paper here.
That you can also do this directly without a bias. Anyway, so polarization is really important for lensing, because polarization gives you extra handles. So all these fields, all the E, B, T and E fields, they get lensed. And so you can form estimators for lensing out of combinations of these fields. So you can have TE, EB, BB, okay? And as I told you already, lensing causes E2B conversion, and it's lensing that produces, you know, EB correlations in the CMB. And here are some of the projections that we have for ACT fold. Of course, this does not assume, you know, foregrounds and other systematics, but if you just look at, you know, the proposed noise levels of ACT fold, then with ACT fold, here is your signal, CLDD, the power spectrum of the deflection field, and here is the power spectrum of the noise that you can get if you combine all these different combinations of estimators optimally. So you can see between, you know, L until like L of 500, you can really reconstruct this deflection field with high signal to noise, which would mean that this deflection field that you get from it on the patch of the sky that has been observed by ACT fold would basically reconstruct the projected density of matter, which is a really nice scaffolding to cross-correlate other things with.
One.
I haven't looked at the projections for that. Yeah, but it might be very interesting to actually look at that. But, and here is another configuration
of the actual survey. So that was a deep survey of 150 square degrees, and we are also trying to do a 4,000 square degree survey, which is wider. And here you see, here also you can actually get the large scale part of the deflection field quite well, and which would mean that on these 4,000 square degree patch of the sky, any other data set that we have, we can cross-correlate and learn in turn about things that in those data sets. For example, say we cross-correlate, you know, quasars, then we learn about the bias of the quasar by cross-correlating.
Sorry?
the optimal. So Hirata claims that these EB or these estimators are non-optimal because the B is really noise-free, so you can do much better than that if you have low enough noise.
Right.
So your noise estimator does not include those corrections by Hirata's.
No.
So you could do better even than that.
You could do better.
Finally, post-born means more than one landing.
One landing plane.
The equation I wrote down, it's just, you know, basically one deflection, but then you can do multiple planes, and that gives rise to corrections. That really has worked on that. But one of the nice things you can get from measuring this CLGB, if you can do that, and I hope we can do that in a few years' time, is a constraint on neutrino mass. And this is like the last part of the talk. So we know from oscillation experiments that, you know, the neutrinos have mass, and there are two possible hierarchies of neutrino mass, with the normal and the inverted hierarchy. We don't know which one is which. But what happens is, if you have neutrinos that have sub-electron volt mass, they behave as radiation in early times, but they start behaving, they're non-relativistic at later times. But still, they have enough velocity dispersion not to cluster on small scale. So in this picture, what happens is that if you have both neutrinos and cold dark matter on large scales, big enough scales larger than the free streaming length of the neutrinos, both will cluster. Whereas on small scales, only the cold dark matter will cluster. So you end up with deeper wells here than you get here, which means that in the power spectrum space, you actually get, with higher neutrino mass, you get a decrement in the power at small scales or high scales. So here, the green is the fiducial value with zero neutrino mass, and the blue here is when you have, you know, these numbers as the sum of the neutrino mass. So of course, you can do this game with galaxies. So you can measure this power spectrum with galaxies. But with doing with galaxies, you have this additional source of uncertainty that comes from not knowing the bias of the galaxies exactly. So from the galaxy power spectrum, you have to infer the underlying dark matter power spectrum, and in between there is this bias, which could be scale and redshift dependent. Why CMB lensing is nice is because it's directly probing the dark matter, and it's probing it at a ratio of 2 and 3, but its effect is actually a little more pronounced. And so with CMB lensing alone, you can actually put really competitive constraints on the sum of neutrino masses. So for example, for ACTPOL, you know, you could go down to something like 0.06 electron volts in the sum of the neutrino masses. From CMB lensing. And so this gives kind of like a summary of what we know from cosmology about the sum of neutrino masses right now. So right now it's about, you know, 0.46 or something from weak lensing and galaxy surveys. But then with Planck, we should be able to do something like about here, it's like sum of neutrino masses of 0.15. But if you add Planck and ACTPOL, although ACTPOL is on a much smaller piece of sky, 4,000 square degrees, then you can actually constrain the sum with an error of about 0.06 electron volts. And when you get to that limit, you're starting to probe, you know, all this problem of hierarchy, and you can start constraining hierarchy of neutrinos with this new probe of CMB lensing. And not only that, putting in CMB lensing lets you improve on other things, which I'll not go into at the moment. So the last thing I'm going to just throw up, because my time has run out, is cross-correlation science. So already the ACTMAPs are producing really nice results with cross-correlation. So these are cross-correlations in temperature. So we see very faint dust signals for the galactic dust in our maps. This is work done by Amir, where he has cross-correlated ACT and BLAST, and we see these correlated point sources in our maps. You know, we have a nice signal which kind of really shows that point sources are, there's a correlated part in the point source distribution. And here's a neat result where we stacked the CMB maps behind SDSS LRGs, and we see the Sunayev-Zeldovich decrement corresponding to groups and clusters on the SDSS map. But another kind of cross-correlation that you can do, as I told you, is with this reconstructed convergence field with, you know, galaxy lensing. For example, if you have galaxy lensing on the same piece of the sky as you do CMB lensing, then you can show that you can by adding these to the CMB only constants, you can reduce the error bars on sum of neutrino mass and
by a big factor. Same if you have just galaxy density map on the sky, for which you have characterized the bias correctly, then you can actually have almost a factor of two improvement over just seeing the only constraints. By cross, so this is for Herschel cross with Planck. This is the kind of cool improvement that you can get. Okay, so we are doing a pilot study by cross-correlating the ACT maps with the CFHT weak lensing maps on Stripe82, and this is work with Alexi Lyoto at LBL. There are other kind of cross-correlation measurements that you can do, but since I've run out of time, I'll just throw it up. You can measure geometry with CMB lensing and galaxy lensing, and you can measure directly growth of structure by doing a tomographic cross-correlation in virtual fields. So, for summary, CMB, you know, both CMB lensing and the fact that we can now measure the higher order peaks themselves are really, really very exciting times in CMB physics. And they're really giving us new flavors of time, and there's a lot to look forward to. Thank you.
Maybe while Josef comes and sets up, we have time for one question. I couldn't hear. I have a feeling maybe this was the subject of John and Wei-Li's conversation. But was the upshot that you can find the basis that you were talking about? You need to know a priori the Lambda fielders, but that's the Lambda potential.
No, you don't need to know that.
What was the comment about what manifold was in the sphere?
It's the eigenspace of the covariance matrix. So a Gaussian random field, if it's stationary, it depends only on the separation. If it's not stationary, it depends on all kinds of stuff. But it is still a quadratic covariance matrix, which still can be diagonalized. So if it's stationary, then the diagonal frame of a covariance matrix are just Fourier modes. And if it's not stationary, then the diagonal frames are something complicated.
But there's an actual distribution data. You're saying they don't.
On the actual distribution
of matter and the lensing potential.
Matter and the lensing potential. Well, it depends on your potential, yeah. So you have to
I mean, I need to back that up, because basically what you're saying
exactly.
Is that I twist things, I untwist them, it turns down to zero.
But always fine, it's stationary.
I should be able to do the same exercise for large-scale structure in K-space as opposed to
L-space.
Because that's got a displacement. I'm not going to deal. Actually, we have the issue of crossing here, but I'm going to ignore that for the moment. Now, what you're telling me is that then I can look at the large-scale structure in the sky and say, you see, that's really Gaussian, and that's a very tall comet.
Well,
so there's something a little mysterious.
That's what these
about
reconstruction
this.
People claim to do, right? So people who
they're de-Gaussianizing.
So these
are Gaussian.
Exactly. By displacing some along.
You know you can't really do that.
Well, because crossing, yeah. I mean, in practice, as you say, there are real limitations. So, but CMB is linear, so for CMB you don't have that restriction.
But this new frame that you're talking about won't depend in any way on the detection field itself?
No, okay, so the new field is an eigenframe, and I can go through the algebra with you, but the eigenframe is something you measure, and the eigenvectors tell you what the reflection field was, right? So basically, there's a direct mapping
some level, you
of what you observe.
You're reconstructing the eigenspaces, which you'd only be able to do at an approximate level, and they've got all sorts of statistics attached to them.
And basically, so deep, there is a simple way of actually doing this pair of patches. It's like a 10-line program can do any number of patches you want. If you go through the kappa-gamma constructions, you can just apply a local filter to it, and then you can have a lossless. I mean, it's a very, very simple algorithm that actually implements your technique on little patches. I think that's...
We'll implement that and we'll detect lensing by the end of the week. Okay.
There you go.
Okay, so our next speaker will be setting up.